Identity Theft, an exposition of Colossians chapter 2, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 4. This message by guest preacher Reverend Bill Parker was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Sunday evening, March the 2nd, 2008.
It is good to be in a church that has pews and has pianos and a pulpit. A lot of the churches that I get a chance to go to and be with are churches that are meeting in schools or in auditoriums or something rented, or even one church in Minneapolis, they meet in a cinema, which is on the campus of Minnesota State. It's one of the churches that I'm involved with. And for those of you who don't know, I help churches in pioneer places connect with churches in the Bible Belt, for lack of a better term. Churches that I call that are on the bubble. And what I mean by on the bubble, it means that they are questionable if they're going to survive or not. Have you ever been in a church you wonder if you're going to survive or not? That's when you kind of look at the end of the month and people go, how are we going to pay this bill? And how are we going to rent? You know, and they pass the hat. And, you know, and those are lean places. Have you ever been in one of those? It's tough to live in a church in that existence. Well, a lot of churches in pioneer places are in those type of circumstances. And I had a chance to go to Aurora, Colorado. I mentioned that this morning, and help a church there connect. I do a lot of video things, and I help this church by doing a video of their church, kind of promo of what they do. Now, they've been in Aurora, Colorado for 7 years in a place called the Green Valley Ranch area. And I did an interview with the pastor, and I'm going to put that on video and also use it as a way for that church as a promo for them to explain their background. Well, they meet in a public school. There are approximately 29,000 homes in the community in which they live. But there are no church facilities in the development area. The person who developed the housing addition, of course, did not want to give up any property for a church building. So they have schools in the development, but there are no church facilities in the development. And so the church rents from the school. It's Marama Public School is who they rent from. And so they've been there for almost 7 years. 5 years, I guess, they've been in existence, but in the school 5 years, and the last couple of years, they've been switching back from a couple of different schools. They meet on Saturday night. They worship at 6 o'clock. On a Saturday night, they don't meet on Sunday mornings. And so I asked the pastor, I said, why do you do that? And he said, well, we've discovered that in our area, people who don't go to church have never been to church really, or at least not very often. Sunday morning is not a big deal to them, that they have to be at church on Sunday. So really, if it's based upon whenever you have a meeting and they know somebody in that meeting, that's when they will come. And so he was explaining to me about how the church operated. We went and visited the church on a Saturday night a few weeks ago and had a great experience, good worship time, and got to meet a lot of the people. And he was explaining about where their church is at. You know, what's the next thing that they're going to do? They're bumped up around 70, and they haven't been able to get over that number. That's a big number for churches, 70 to 100, 100 to 150. And then for churches that are never been there before, getting to 200 is a big deal. And then growing beyond. Those are challenging numbers for small churches to get past. And so I said, tell me what it was like to start a church in this area. He said, well, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, there were six different churches starting in that community. And he said, we decided that we would meet at a time when nobody else was meeting so that we'd be beneficial to the rest of the churches. He said, in that six-year period of time, guess how many of those churches are left? One. They are the only church that's remaining in a community of 29,000 homes. It's the only Southern Baptist church in a 10-mile radius area of that amount of population. He said they're behind the curve about 30 years if they were to be starting and developing churches there. And so the question arose, said, well, why do you think you survived and the others didn't survive? And he said this, he said, because our attitude was not to get something from the people who lived here. The other people who started the churches simply put up a sign and they opened up their services. He said, people who are not churched are not looking for a service. And it's interesting, even people in our area, if they're not churched, they're not looking for a church service. And he said, what we had to do is build some relationships with people who didn't have any idea of what really church was about. He said they're self-satisfied. They have some money because they have homes, right? And they have some resources. And they think that the church wants their time, their money, and their resources. He said the only way for us to combat that is for us to show them we care about them more than what they have. So we developed a philosophy, this pastor did, that we would serve people. And so some different times they do landscaping for people in their community as an act of service. They have nothing in return. They will stand on the corners in the mornings when people are going out to work and hand them a breakfast in a sack, compliments of the Hope Valley Church, giving them something and not trying to take something from them. And this was a bold thing. I thought it was really out there. I don't know if this would be something I would do. Maybe I should do. Lord might humble me to do it at some point. They would go to the local businesses and they would ask the businesses, can we wash your restrooms? And they said, why would you do that? We want to serve our community. And one of the people that he would go to in this community and ask, how can we help you? How can we serve you? Was a local liquor store. And so they went to the liquor store and they asked the man, can we wash your restroom? And the man said no. 3 months in a row, the man said no, I'm not going to let you do that. Finally, he said, tell me, you're a church, and I know you don't endorse alcohol, and yet I'm a liquor store, and you've come to clean our restrooms. Why would you do that? Most people would picket our establishment rather than to serve us. And the pastor had the opportunity to tell the man, he said, we want to serve you because we care about you. He said, we could have picketed the man or we could serve the man. And by serving the man, he had the opportunity to share the gospel with him. Now, isn't that interesting? That simple acts of service really draw the attention of a world that's questioning us. One of the things that I had the chance to see was a woman named Addie when I was at this church. I went to their leadership team meeting on a Sunday morning. Addie, I guess, is about 30 years old. She's a mother of two children. And she told her story of how she became a believer. She was in an apartment complex where one of the members of the church had come by and brought her a care package and invited her to church 3 or 4 different times. They finally came to church on a Saturday night. They listened to the pastor's message. The husband came up to the pastor and said, I've been to church a few times. He said, this does not feel like church to me. He said, I'd like to know more about it. Pastor met with him at lunch. The man prayed to receive Christ, and his wife the following weekend prayed to receive Christ. It was a pretty neat thing to hear a woman tell the story about how she became a believer. And now, guess what she does? She's the person who does the care packages in her community and invites people to church as well. So it's an exciting thing to see a church on the bubble, but it's still making ground in people's lives. And that's my goal and my position is to help a church like that connect with another church who can send people, money, and resources to help them get beyond that bubble. And we go for 5 years. We try not to create a welfare church where you just send money and then create a church that's not really becoming independent. But we go for 5 years with a distinct beginning and a distinct end. I do other things as well, but to do a lot of video things for churches that can't afford video equipment or editing and that sort of thing. And so that's some of the things that happen. I really appreciate Trinity because they opened up for me as a young man the opportunity to use some creative ideas, and it kind of opened that idea for me to do ministry in a different way and to see that God still uses this church to throw men and women into ministry. In fact, I was in Haskell, America. You know where Haskell is. And was getting ready to preach. I was filling in for a friend of mine who has just been called to be their pastor. And this young, good-looking guy stood up and began to speak. And he said his name was Abel, Tim Abel. I thought, boy, that sounds really familiar to me. And he can sing, and he can speak, and he knows how to work a crowd. They were laughing and having a good time. And I thought, wow, here's another one that's come out of these family relationships here, out of Bob and Dee and his family. And it's a neat thing to see people thrown into ministry. And I myself, being a young man, had the opportunity here to preach for the first time at John 3:16 Mission Center. And my friend Rick was there with me the day that we went. I think, Jay Fred, you got me roped down there for some reason. And I'll never forget, I was preaching and a guy had a boot and a tennis shoe on. I said, it's the same guy, you know, a boot and a tennis shoe on. And I got a chance to share, and I was as nervous as a cat, and got a chance to preach. And then we had a bowl of beans with those fellas. But what a great opportunity. And still today, I remember somebody taking this initiative to do that. And guys like Bill Eubanks, who was kind of called around that same period of time, and Andy Taylor, who came out of this church as well. And I'm probably saying names that many of you may not even know about at all, but it's just good to see a church that has an identity. And maybe you're here tonight, a young man, young woman, and God's going to throw you into ministry, and this church will probably have a key place in the launching of your life into the lives of other people. That is not at all what I plan to say. But we're gonna go ahead and look at the Bible together and start from this point. If you have your Bible, open it with me to Colossians chapter 2, and we're going to finish out the rest of this scam that can happen to people. One of the scams that's happening right now is identity theft. A good friend of mine in Fort Gibson, America, had somebody get into his mailbox, and they got a hold of his bank account and a credit card account and went down and began to steal his identity. Fortunately, he caught it pretty early, but it took him about a month and a half to get it straightened out. If you've ever known anybody who someone's taken their identity or charged things on their bank account or credit card account, it is a nightmare to get those things straightened out, especially if it's ruined your credit. Now, it's something that you're warned about. You may have received in the mail recently, I don't know if you did or not, from the U.S. Post Office, some things to protect yourself from identity theft. Don't just throw anything in the trash, right? Because people do this thing called dumpster diving. And they'll go in there and find your name and your account number, and they'll go in and they'll try to steal your identity. You've seen those commercials, right, haven't you, on television? And it shows these two ladies, and they have voices like men, like motorcycle guys, and talking about how they had taken different things from different people. It's a real thing. How you view yourself really determines how you live. How you view your identity determines how you live. Now, I want to say that to you as an individual. How do you view yourself? Who are you? Who do you determine in your heart is the core of your character? Because it's that way in which you view yourself, really, it'll be the way in which you treat other people. Have you ever seen people who are mean and harsh and harm to others? Have a lot of harm to other people? They have a bad attitude? That's probably a really good indication of how they view themselves because of the way how they'll treat other people. How you view yourself is critical. And in the Bible, it gives us a great picture of how important it is that we never view ourselves in a light of negativity. We should view ourselves as children of God. Who we worship and how we worship reflects on how we view ourselves in relationship to God. Now, I'm saying that because identity theft is one of those key things that the enemy will try to rob you of. Look at the text in verse 18. Chapter 2 of Colossians, verse 18. Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. There was a movement at this time that people were worshiping angels, and also pretending and throwing out a false humility. And that type of worship isn't pleasing to God. It also diminishes Christ's position. Anything that you worship, if we worship anything other than Jesus Christ, then we actually diminish ourselves, but we also diminish Him. And it has harm to us in how we relate to God. And it says in verse 19, "And not holding fast to the head, from whom all the body nourished and knit together by joints and ligaments grows with the increase that is from God." And another point, another reference that if we're not placing Christ at the centerpiece of how we worship, of how we spend a relationship with Him, then we're diminishing His authority in our life. We have to be careful in church at times that we not make our tradition our God. I've been attending a church. I'll give you my own spiel about this. I didn't think I liked traditional music until I didn't have it for a long period of time. I attend a church when I'm not at another church, and it's called Fusion Church. And it's a church designed to reach 18 to 25-year-olds. Now, there is nothing familiar in the music for me. Now, I don't go to that church because the music is familiar. I go to that church because they are specifically trying to reach the 18 to 25-year-old range. And I believe in that. I believe that we should do whatever we can to reach that group. So they play a lot of guitar they have drums and bongos, and the people who are in the worship are 25. And I cannot tell you really any of those songs. A few that I can catch. But sometimes I miss that traditional song. I miss the hymns because I like hymns. But I know what that function of that church is. But I have found myself at times wanting to sing a hymn because I'm used to it, not because it is necessarily the thing that I should be doing. Have you ever found yourself in that? Sometimes we can get used to the trappings of our worship and we can miss the purpose of why we worship. Does that make any sense? Or am I kind of out there? I'm getting some question marks, I can tell, on people's faces. Now, we don't ever want to place a thing above our relationship with Christ. That's why Jesus said He doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. And neither does He live in the traditions of men. We don't want to put those things in a higher place or priority in our relationship with Him. And you know what I've discovered? That I don't always have to have the things that I always like to worship God. And here's something else. Sometimes you can worship God with a new song in a new way with somebody else's instrument. And He is still there. He is still prevalent. He is still leading and directing. Freedom from improper worship is one of the things that God gives us. He gives us freedom of identity. Look at verse 20. "Therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why through living in the world do you subject yourself to regulations? Do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things which perish with the using, according to the commandments and the doctrines of men. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion and false humility and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh." Paul is saying, don't make your outward sign of worship your vehicle for relating to God. You could be pious. You could be aesthetic in terms of harming your body, depriving yourself of food, of going through some really challenging spiritual ritual. But what does Paul say? That is of no spiritual effect. That's just on the outside. That's not on the inside. Look at the last part of that verse. Look what it says. "These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility and neglect of the body. But look what he says. But they are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. Some folks have a weird idea that if they have done some harm against God, they can punish themselves, and by punishing themselves, they will have somehow make up for their past sin and it will be pleasing to God. You cannot control your flesh by self-will. Typically when that happens, it is the reverse. It becomes worse. It becomes more of a challenge. It becomes more of a habitual thing that destroys your life when you try to place physical controls over your life. Have you ever met someone who quit some sin but then added another sin to replace it? They may have quit smoking, but they've added gluttony to the other side. They may have stopped drinking, but they've taken on some other type of adrenaline-kicking activity. Human beings can shift from one sin to the next, but without being made new in Christ, we cannot have a real change that produces real discipline. And the discipline that's mentioned here in this text is a false identity of who you are. We don't want to be people who are so well disciplined we can control our life by our own discipline. You know why? You can't do it. If you can control your life by your own discipline, then why do you need Jesus? And the Bible teaches us that when our sin runs rampant, it destroys us. And we need Christ to protect us, to guide us, to tell us no and to stop it. We need to depend upon Him and not upon our own, for lack of a better term, use the term here, religious activity or ritual or self-imposed religion. These are lies that destroy our esteem. Our esteem is how we view ourselves. You may say this and have heard this lie. It comes kind of out of the same thing as far as robbing us of our identity. If I could only be seen by other people as legitimate, I would have value. Do you remember those awkward teenage years when you really wanted to be cool? Did anybody ever just really want to be cool? When you walk down the hall, you wanted people just to go, wow, that person's cool. I guess maybe I'm the only one that ever had that experience. Thank you. You wanted people to like you for, you want to be drawn in, right? And you think, if they just like me, if I just did this one or two things, then I'd be legitimate and they'd like me and it would just be great. Let me tell you, that's a lie. That's a lie because the assumption is that you're not enough with what you have. If I could only be legitimate, if... And that robs you of your identity. Here's the next lie. If others would only recognize my value, if they could just see how important I am, if they could look past this facade and see how brilliant and intelligent I am, if they could just see how beneficial I could be to them, these lies rob us of our esteem. Because the Bible teaches us that God sees us as we are. He sees us and He esteems us as valuable. We don't need another person to tell us that. It's hard to know that, isn't it? Sometimes we want somebody else to affirm us. But really, here's the bottom line. If you're affirmed by God, who else do you need? You don't need the world standard. If I only had this gift, if I only had this spiritual gift or ability, if I could only compare myself to someone else, if I could only sing like this person, if I could only preach like this person, if I only had that body that person has, or then I would be legitimate. If I only had a supernatural experience, if I could just be on the Damascus Road, if I could just somehow do something that other people would recognize as really important, If I only had this one thing, I would be complete. These are lies that rob us of our esteem. Because the Bible teaches us that we are a... What does 1 Peter say? I'll look at it with me if you would. Look at that particular text. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. Peter writes to the early church and he says this, "But you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, His own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." We are the child of the King. We are His generation. And when we see ourselves like this, it changes our purpose. It changes our identity. The enemy longs for us to see ourselves as we once were. I kind of clarify that, as we once were. To see ourselves in the muck of our sin and the failure of our past. Look at, this is another text that goes back to how the enemy perceives us. Look at Revelation chapter 12, if you would, and verse 10. It's a picture of how Satan deals with believers and deals with folks who are really kind of grappling with their identity. Verse 10 says, "Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, 'Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives even unto death.'" The idea here is that, okay, every time, as far as what the spiritual realm happens, when you're reminded of your sin and your past, let's say you committed some act that was just heinous, whatever it is. And then every time you go back in your mind and your memory and you remember what you've done that's wrong, the enemy points his finger at you and says, "See? See what you did? See what you've done? Who do you think you are? Attending church. Who do you think you are teaching a Sunday school class? Who do you think you are standing up and praising God in front of all those people when you've done all these horrendous, awful things?" And if you think of yourself like that and you listen to that type of language in your mind, guess how you view yourself? You view yourself as a person who has failed. But the Bible says that we have a person who stands as our defense attorney. And he is the person, Jesus Christ. And he stands and he handles that prosecuting accusation. And he says, "Yes, they've done this. Yes, they have failed. Yes, they've committed those sins. But I paid that price for them on the cross. And they are no longer what they used to be. They were changed when they received me, and they are a new creature. And their identity isn't based upon their past sin. Their identity is based on their present position as my child." Amen. Jesus becomes our defense attorney. So you no longer have to look at your life by the failure that you what you haven't been. You look at your life by what God has done for you. And let's even go a step further than that. You look at your life, not what you've been, how you've been, not how you failed. You look at your life, how God sees your life. And He sees what you can become. You know when Christians lose their hope? When they fail to see what God can do. When they fail to see what God can do. Because God always looks at every human being with hope. I did a funeral for a woman this week, 93 years old. Her name was Carrie QV Roberts. She was 93 years old, and she had six Bibles. And in her Bibles were just tucked everything. I found Lelways to Sears from 1972, letters from her sisters. Didn't find any emails in there or any text messages. Letters from different people and things that she had written out. Sometimes she'd just write down things from the Bible that she had in there. And she had different things underlined. And I asked her family, 93 years old, I said, tell me, what was it that allowed her to live beyond the normal age? You know, only 8% of people in the world live to be 93 years old. She got into a pretty exclusive club there. And her family said, you know, she had a rough life. She was born in 1915. She was married in 1930. Do the math. She was 15 years old when she got married. And she began to have children in 1930. Guess what was happening? Great Depression was happening. The family said that they actually had to live under a tree at one point. She had to raise her children basically by herself. And I asked that family, I said, tell me, what do you think her secret was? It's my uncle. It's his mother. He said she always thought tomorrow would be better. I want to tell you what, with Christians, we have a hope. Tomorrow is better. Because we have the presence of Jesus Christ. What's the worst thing that can happen to you? What's the worst thing that can happen to you? You go home to be with Christ. That's the worst thing that can happen to you if you're a believer. Jesus Christ has hope. I want to tell you what, if you've ever been to a church that's lost its hope, it's a sad story. You know what they're waiting on? They're waiting on somebody. They're waiting on morticians. And they're waiting on somebody to close the door. Well, I tell you what, never lose your hope. There's another family. There's another person who's waiting to hear the good news of Jesus Christ. There is another life that's about to be given to the ministry. There's another family that's about to be held together. Don't give up your hope. God has something good in store for you, for your church, and for you personally. And tomorrow, there is hope in the person in the presence of Christ. It changes you the way you see yourself, changes how you live and your identity in the person of Jesus Christ. Gosh, I left my Bible back here somewhere. Look with me to chapter 3 of Colossians. Speaking of hope, and I probably should close with this next section. If then you were raised with Christ, and you were. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with Him in glory. That is our hope in the person of Jesus Christ. I hope your identity is based in Him. Will you pray with me as we close out?
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.